I invite you to open your Bibles to the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah's burden for a broken wall was a reflection of God's sorrow as well. And ultimately, it was this shared grief which motivated this man of God, this man of faith, to take action. Now, in the opening verses of the book of Nehemiah, we have the record of his inquiry from his brother Hanani concerning his countrymen back over yonder there in Jerusalem. It may be that he was a bit idealistic, just a wee so. After all, a party had already gone by, and that's found there in the first six chapters of the book of Ezra, which is a counterpart book to Nehemiah. And Jews had gone to Jerusalem, and they began the restructuring of the temple area, particularly the part that had to do with the sacrificial system. And word, of course, would have filtered back to Nehemiah and those who remained in exile. And now as he questioned how all of it was actually going on, how all of it was transpiring, he discovers that there was a subsequent intervention to make the project grind to a halt. And in halting, as with just many works out there, it does not simply sit stationary or idle. It regresses. It deteriorates. It disintegrates. For it's either going forward or it's going back, but it certainly is not staying still. And whatever idealism may have been there as part of his aspirations initially, this report gave a healthy dose of realism. While he was likely hopeful to hear stories of the secrets of success for the people back there in Jerusalem, rather he is brought to a bit of a brink with the facts of their failure. And so we see here in that first chapter how he reacts, and then subsequently he shall go into action. But now first here, reaction. That's chapter 1 by way of review. We understand and teach our children that we can never control the way that others act, but we have control over how it is that we react, how we respond. Someone cuts us off there in traffic. We are the ones who react. Someone steals your parking spot. We are the ones who react. Someone is unkind to you at a party. We are the ones who react. We don't get what we feel that we deserve. We are the ones who react. And that principle is so fixed that we end up revealing a good deal about ourselves, about what's in our heart, based upon how we respond in given situations. And so it is with Nehemiah. And application abounds to leadership. Those who are being led are going to take a read from the leaders. Back there in the book of Numbers, you have a classic example, do you not? Just as the people were poised to go into the promised land, and spies were sent initially. Canaan is where they were headed. The Lord promised that to them. And so it was not a question of would they be going to Canaan, but rather the question was what would it be like when they got there? So the spies were not to be determining if they should end up there in Canaan. Rather, this was much like a Lewis and Clark expedition, a grand land survey. And so they went up from the desert of Paran, up the Negev, to the hill country, to see what it'd be like, the people, the towns, the walls, the fortifications. Take a look at the soil. Is it rich? Is it fertile? Bring back an irrigation report. So off they went to fulfill the brief. And they came back to Kadesh, and they reported to the whole assembly of Israel. And so the way those spies, those leaders react, will have a huge impact on the people gathered together. And we know how this turns out. They said, number one, yes, absolutely. It flows with milk and honey, and here is its fruit. But they launch into a very negative statement, regarding the potential of inhabiting this country. And there's a trickle-down effect. Gasps and shocks of horror just overtake the people. I mean, they're stunned. Caleb reacts to the reaction. He silences the people. He says, we should do this because God has enabled us. We are well equipped. For God represents a majority over and above the dwellers of the land of Canaan. The 10 spies saw only the problems that were there. And no doubt they would have been ticked and irked by Joshua and Caleb. Who does Caleb think that he is? Who does this Joshua think that he really is? These rabble-rousers. After all, 12 of us went up. Now watch. Does it matter the way that the leaders reacted? Absolutely. The people were scared. They were dazed and confused. They were all turned around. They got mixed up with all this talk here about giants. And consequently, all the Israelites raised their voices and wept aloud, crying there on their beds, grumbling on their feet. It was a consequence of leadership. So listen up. Whether we're talking about just a handful there at the office, or whether we're talking about those that we're going to teach in a Bible class, friends, colleagues, co-workers, they're going to gain more from the way we react at times than from a mere proclamation of what exactly is going to be taking place. Now, Nehemiah's reaction, chapter 1, verse 4, I sat down and wept. Passion and compassion are usually linked. Here is the genuine article. And Nehemiah was not concerned primarily about architecture. You see, it's a little over the top to get so worked up over what would now actually be like ancient ruins. But rather, this was indicative of a beleaguered situation there for God's people. Do tears come easily to you? Are you a crier? Do you cry when you watch Anne of Green Gables or old Jimmy Stewart movies? Or are we of the stiff upper lip brigade? We don't cry about much. Yet when was the last time that we wept over God's spiritual affection and the fact that the condition among the people is unresponsive? We can cry for ourselves, but do we cry for others? It's as real as it gets. There's a Jim Reeves song that goes, how long has it been since you talked with the Lord and told Him your heart's hidden secrets? How long since you prayed? How long since you stayed on your knees till the light shone through? Tears cannot be externally manufactured. They've got to be God-created tears. And we have a work to do because it is divinely appointed. There has to be, friends, an emotional investment. Nehemiah was all bussed up. And I don't gather that he's necessarily wasting a lot of time saying, what exactly is going on with the clowns back over there in Jerusalem? Those yo-yos up there got to come up there to straighten it all out. Rather, he weeps. He's dropping to the ground. He fasted and prayed there in verse 4 of that first chapter. So he goes to God immediately and for what would seem to be like nearly forever, because we're talking about a four-month stretch. Now, prayer is not manipulating God to give us what He doesn't want to give. It's obtaining blessings that God is willing to bestow. It's not about coaxing and cajoling Him to do what He doesn't really want to do. It's not about overcoming God's reluctance. It's laying hold of His willingness. And Nehemiah understands that point, you see, because this is God's work, so surely God is going to find a way. He's not going to be overly concerned with the nitty-gritty details. He could go nearly insane trying to figure all of that out. Rather, he resorts to trust, and we ought to as well. And indeed, God comes through. That's all found there in the second chapter. So, do we pray? Once a day? Nonce a day? once a week, once a week? And is passion in our prayer? I think of the John Burton poem, "I often say my prayers, but do I ever pray? And do the feelings of my heart go with the words I say? I might as well bow down and worship gods of stone as offer to the living God a prayer of words alone. For words without the heart the Lord will never hear, nor will He to those lips attend whose prayers are not sincere." Let us love the brotherhood and bear a burden together. Pray for one another that you might be healed. So says James there in James 5:16. Pray for God's kingdom and its increase. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We want to see the manifestation of God's kingdom in the lives of individuals. That's Matthew 6, verse 10. Pray it up, plan it up. That is the MO for Nehemiah, and we're going to see that throughout this whole book. Now, there are some words with a suffix that we're going to hang some thoughts on here, if I might. All of these words will end in ation, A-T-I-O-N, ation. And so if that is a helpful device for memory, then our purpose is well served in that. Look over here at chapter 2, verse 11. "So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode." Point number one, motivation. I mean, you think about this here. He's just shown up now. Nehemiah, why are you doing this? Why did you come here to Jerusalem? Didn't you have a good job over there in Susa? Do you like long journeys? Was it that you were just bored? And you know, people may look on and make all manner of incorrect assessments. Well, maybe he just wants to make a name for himself. Anytime you have a leader, and you know that you're going to be a leader when people are following, then we also have to allow for the reality that there are going to be occasional second guessers. And maybe they're harping on just about every decision. Leaders have to be prepared to allow people to assume certain things without it completely disarming them or alarming them. I mean, you think there about the Apostle Paul. Did he not have his own share of critics? Armchair quarterbacks? Absolutely, that was so. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, there in verse 3, 1 Corinthians 4, verse 3, he says, "But with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by a human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. For I know of nothing against myself, yet I'm not justified by this, but he who judges me is the Lord." Over in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, there in verse 17. He says, "Therefore, when I was planning this, did I do it lightly? Or the things I plan, do I plan according to the flesh, that with me there should be yes, yes, and no, no? But as God is faithful, our word to you was not yes and no." In other words, I don't have absolute certainty. He was dealing with the disappointment that was hurled his way over an inability to arrive at a particular time. Look over at the 10th chapter, 2 Corinthians chapter 10, there in verse 10. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 10. "For his letters, they say, are weighty and powerful, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech contemptible." He says, "Let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters when we are absent, such we will also be indeed when we are present." In other words, Paul does not want to just talk a big talk. Rather, he is going to walk a consistent walk. There's going to be the political pundits out there coming to weigh in, but it will have no impact on the determination of a leader to do what is right. Think of how much energy we spent just this past week thinking of what someone did and trying to assess if it was a good decision or a bad decision. Look, all of that is germane to leadership. Now, we know why Nehemiah is there, but others do not yet get it. He says it's about what God had put there in his heart. Nehemiah 2 verse 12. So he's not a member of the Susa Architectural Society. He's not a member of the Restoration Association of Old Buildings. He's not a member of the Conservation Society. This can only be explained by allowing God to work there in his life. Can I ask us, what is our intentions? What would be the intentions that we have? What has God put in our heart to do as we study out his word and allow it to come to life for us? Is there a burning, driving, compassionate contribution for the church here? And also to reach out to those in the community with the gospel of Christ. We are not here by chance, but rather by divine appointment. Lives intersecting by God's grace and God's good hand. We are not on a fool's errand. We are not here for merely a holy huddle to just slap each other on the back. We are to be visionaries for the gospel of Christ, doing God's work in God's way. And when motivation is proper and God-centered, guess what? God's people in turn can follow. What are we doing here with this church? Might I sum it up in just two words? This is what it's about. Number one, edify. Number two, multiply. You'll find that there in Acts chapter 9. Acts chapter 9, there in verse 31, we have our model that's provided. Acts chapter 9, there in verse 31. Then the churches throughout all Judea, Galilee, and Samaria had peace and were what? And were edified. And walking in the fear of the Lord and in the comfort of the Holy Spirit, they were what? They were multiplied. Edify, multiply. We are evangelizing the lost so that they might know the Lord. And we are edifying the saved. So that in being built up, the saved can be multiplied. What are you doing next week? Same thing. What about the week after that? Any change of plans? No. I mean, we have our mandate. So edifying and multiplying, that's it. Preaching is done to build people up in the faith or to help people to come to faith. But in being built up, we realize it's not just about expanding our head there with knowledge. We are being inspired to go out and replicate ourselves. Number two, examination. Examination. Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 13. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuse gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem which were broken down, and its gates which were burned with fire. Good leaders are going to be ever vigilant for what others can end up missing. People going to church for years and years may not realize how much better indeed it could be if we all had but a mind to work. We can be but one generation away from total degeneration in the Lord's church. So stay active. I mean, look at this here. In verse 17, you see the distress that we are in? Do you not see the trouble that we are in? But the reality was that many might have actually missed that. They were so familiar with it that it may not have really stood out. In the My Fair Lady musical, you have there a song by Rex Harrison that goes, "I've grown accustomed to her face." And as I think about that and apply it to our situation here with this study, you had undoubtedly some who had grown accustomed to disgrace. I mean, when you look there at a room there at the house that might be steadily building with clutter, initially it might not seem so off. But then you have someone from the outside come on in. They can point it out, but you say, "Oh, well, what's so wrong about this?" You see, well, you've grown accustomed. You've grown accustomed to disgrace. Nehemiah, you've come about 1,000 miles. You've prayed for about 4 months. Nehemiah understands this is no vacation. He's on a mission and he's going to be strategic. I have to ask, are you in this world to do something? Or are you in this world for something to do? Big difference. Now, you need number three, information. And that's there with verse 18. He tells them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also the king's words that he had spoken to me. So he talks about the authority of heaven and the authority here on earth. And he says that, look, there is a problem that we are confronting, but this is not just about spelling out a problem. We're spelling out a project. You know, as we motivate and people gain confidence, you can hear just the jubilation connected with that. The excitement. I never thought that I could quite be used in this capacity. I mean, it never occurred to me that I could actually be up here now leading in prayers or leading in songs. I didn't quite know that I had that in me to talk to others about the gospel of Christ. You see how all of this happens at the grassroots level as a seed is planted and allowed to sprout and blossom. And so as you look there at chapter 3, you have delegation and you have implementation. But that takes us over here to chapter 4. And just right quickly, we're going to go ahead and read through this and make some points. It says in chapter 4, verse 1, "But it so happened, when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, that he was furious and very indignant, and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren and the army of Samaria, and said, 'What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned?' Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, 'Whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall.'" And now we have this turning from narration here to the words of Nehemiah himself. "Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads, and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. Do not cover their iniquity, and do not let their sin be blotted out from before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builders." So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, that they became very angry. And all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night. Then Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is failing, and there is so much rubbish that we are not able to build the wall." And our adversary said, "They will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease." So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came, they told us 10 times, "From whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. Oh no." Therefore I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings. And I set the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, and to the rest of the people, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses." And it happened, when our enemies heard that it was known to us, and that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. It was during the days of the Second World War. Winston Churchill, 1940, set in a dungeon there in London and had a little microphone. He was born with a stammer, born with a severe lisp, He was one of the lousiest natural speakers there to walk the streets of that city in London. He took hold of that mic and he said, "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. What is our aim? I answer in one word, victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of terror. Victory no matter what we face." And the little men and women of the communities scattered throughout that island there, all across, they said, "You know, I think that Churchill believes that we can knock back these Germans. You know that? We just come back from work, go down there to the southern coast, get some sticks and shovels, and we can stand against the foe." So from the highest of heights there with the leadership, Parliament, you have the leader who speaks. One word, victory. And then with the grassroots, you have there at that level, people starting to sing. Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think old England's done? We are the lads who will stop your little game. We are the boys who will make you think again. Mr. Brown goes off to town on the 8:31. 3:30, he's home for tea, ready with his gun. Who do you think you're kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you say old England's done? What was that, friends? Leadership. The man with conviction and information and readiness stirred a nation to its feet to face the Nazi tide. And might I say, we also need leadership on every front because we face a powerful foe, but our God is greater. Churchill said, without victory, there's going to be no survival. Nehemiah comes along and says, without this wall, there's only going to be disgrace, scoffing, and shame. And whenever God's work is done in God's way, yes, indeed, there's going to be resistance. Be up for that challenge there. The task of the gospel is not for the mamby-pamby. It's not for the faint-hearted. It's for the tough, the strong, the brave, the true. There's no time left for casual soldiers. It's all about committed infantry. Only the committed may apply, and only the committed sustain it in the battle. For the battle is very intense. How about us? What shall be our story? Let us answer the call, for it is the call of God. If you're not yet a Christian, we encourage you to become one this hour. Jesus gave His precious life for you, that you might live indeed for Him and experience that new life, so refreshing, so rejuvenating, because you have the wellspring there within you, a fountain gushing forth unto eternal life. Let that be yours. If you are subject to the invitation, come to the front while we stand now and sing.